Fantasy Feud, a pitcherless baseball podcast where we're tackling the most relevant debates in fantasy baseball each week. I'm Sarah Sanchez, and I'm here, as always, with my co-host, Shelley Verstrate, to talk through both sides of the hottest fantasy baseball debates right now with some of the greatest minds in the industry. And the good news is that baseball is back. The bad news is that there are injuries everywhere, especially for starting pitchers. Shelley, how are you holding up this week?
It is absolutely crazy. It's like every time, because as most people know, I'm trying to limit my social media, like just trying to get off as much as I can. So it seems like whenever I open up Twitter, it's like, oh, this injury, that injury, this person's hurt, that person's hurt. It's like, this is, I thought I was trying to get away from this, but now it's just awful. Like, I don't, like, if anyone has a team that does not have an injured player, like, I don't know how, like, bravo for you as a drafter. It's amazing. But yeah, it's been awful. Absolutely awful.
Awful is the right word. In fact, in the GLARF Twitter DM or X or whatever we call it these days, we were just talking about this and everybody is like, is this going to disincentivize people from playing? Like, if you dropped a ton of money on a league and you lost Spencer Strider and Shane Bieber and Justin Steele, or Yuri Perez, or like, there are so many outstanding pitchers right now who are hurt. It is bonkers. And Shelley and I are both Red Sox fans, so we're recording this on Tuesday, and both of us had our phone inform us that Nick Pivetta joins the injured elbow brigade. Shelley, I can barely take it.
I can't believe it. It was like totally unexpected because he's been like dominating this season so far. I mean, it's been like what, two starts, something like that. But yeah, I'm just trying to enjoy my salad at lunch. And I just wanted to like throw up my utensils in my salad and just like walk out. I'm like, this is just getting insane. Totally insane.
Totally insane. We're talking starting pitching today. And you knew that if we were going to talk starting pitching on Fantasy Feud, there was one perfect guest for this show. We're excited to welcome Nick Pollock to Fantasy Feud. He insisted that I not call him the man, the myth, the legend. So I'll just say he's the founder of Pitcherless, and he's here to debate out all things in the starting pitcher market today. How's it going, Nick?
What is happening? Well, better when I actually thought you were going to admit it, you know, as opposed to just saying, I wasn't going to say that. I know. Oh, it's so good to be here. Thank you guys so much for having me. As I was telling Shelley earlier, you've made it to 11 episodes, which means this is a real podcast now. Now, when we say like 10 is like, okay, you've made it. Here's 11. I'm super happy to bring on the new era of full legitimacy of you guys here as a podcast. So congratulations. So bad. So glad to be here. If I can say sentences. So glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. We really appreciate the opportunity and we're having a blast with this podcast. It has been super cool to welcome on some of our favorite friends and analysts from the industry to talk through all of these debates. And one of the things that I find kind of interesting, and Shelley, I don't know if you agree, but having the clock and having the speech times and stuff means that we have to move on from these debates in a timely manner, which is not always the thing that happens in fantasy baseball podcasts.
Exactly. I mean, sometimes, you know, you just get on a rant and you just want to like go back and forth with your co-host or a guest or whatever. But yeah, we like to keep it snappy, whatever you want to call it. We like to just move things along because sometimes we got things to discuss.
And things to do. Sometimes snappy, sometimes snippy. Let's review
the rules. Bring me on. I don't understand. If that's what you wanted, you brought on the wrong person.
Well, we brought you on for your expertise in starting pitcher takes, and I think this is going to be a fun one. For new listeners, however, I'm just going to review the rules of the road. This is a debate-focused fantasy baseball podcast. So each person who is debating gets 3 minutes to make their case. Then their opponent gets 3 minutes to make the counter case. There's then a 2-minute question and answer period that might be questions from the moderator or might be questions from the debaters. And then each debater gets a 1-minute rebuttal and then we move on, whether we have solved the world's issues or not. We move on at that point in time and you take what you've learned from that debate and hopefully use it to inform fantasy baseball decisions going forward. I'm going to get this started with our first debate, which is not a player debate, but more a non-fantasy oriented question about baseball injuries right now. And actually, I don't think I am getting this started. Shelley's getting us started as the moderator, I'm messing things up on my own podcast. You're up, Shelby.
I was like, oh, okay, we're going to pivot here. That's cool. That's cool. No, I'm just kidding. Yeah, so we're going to start with something that's not fantasy related. It's just, you know, just baseball in general and how we kind of, you know, started off the show with all of these pitching injuries. Are there more injuries? Does it feel like there's more injuries just because it's like the beginning of the season? Is it because there's so many of the top guys? Like, you know, we got Gerrit Cole, we got Spencer Strider, we got everybody. So what is going on here? Nick, I'll start it out with you.
Yes, there are more injuries, and it makes a ton of sense why. Because there are two major factors. One, the root of the cause is just development in general. Everyone needs to be throwing harder. You need to stand out. You need to get that scholarship. You need to be able to get drafted. You need to stand out in the minor leagues. You have to make it to the majors. And you're not going to do that unless you're throwing a max effort. It's just how it is these days. On the other side of it, you see in the majors, as a baseball owner, you are going to see this massive pool of talent who can now throw 97, 98. And the value of the durable starter isn't as valuable because they don't stand out as much as the rest of the pack. So the whole incentive structure right now is for all of these pitchers to throw as hard as they can, as much as they can. And until there is some understanding of preservation, or at least a focused effort in development at a young age to make guys effective while also being durable, it's just going to continue to happen. So you are seeing more injuries. We've seen it for about 10, 15 years. Ben Lindbergh wrote a great article about it. You should check it out on The Ringer. And yeah, there's no end in sight currently.
Yeah, I'm not going to disagree that there are more injuries. I do think there's a couple of things going on from a nuance perspective that we should be aware of, though. And I do think it's coloring our interpretations of injuries this year. So the first thing is that I was listening to Eno, and I don't remember if it was Eno talking to Nick on the craft or if it was Eno talking to DVR on Rates and Barrels. I listen to too many fantasy baseball podcasts, y'all. I just like walk around the neighborhood and get my steps and listen to fantasy baseball podcasts all the time. But he was talking about how there are spikes with injuries, that we see more injuries in April and we see more injuries in September, and then it kind of calms down a little bit. That makes intuitive sense to me, right? So what we're seeing at this moment in time is that April spike, where pitchers are just coming back and they're just trying to get ramped up and they're realizing that the elbow thing that was bothering them at the end of the year is still bothering them, or the back thing that they thought was going to go away is actually a stress fracture in their rib, a la Julian Merriweather, which, God, Julian Merriweather, get well soon, the Cubs need you. All of those types of hanger-on injuries, and Devin Williams, for example, we're not talking about closers today, but the Devin Williams example is a great one here. He had that back issue at the end of last season. He tried to take the offseason off. He comes back. It's not working. He's still feeling it. And it turns out it's stress fractures in his back, right? Like that is a cyclical thing that is not because of necessarily the way pitchers are throwing or the way they're recovering or what they're doing in the offseason. It is because we're just seeing them try to come back and we're getting all of the injuries at once. The good news there is that probably means that we're going to see them tail off at some point. The bad news is I don't think we're through the woods yet here. Like, it's not just going to be Bieber or Cole or Strider or Perez or Williams or Merriweather or all of the guys that we're talking about and listing here. I think we probably have another week where guys are making their third start or their fourth start where we're going to see some of those injuries emerge. And I'm just crossing my fingers that we can keep the pitching talent as high as it needs to be. The second thing that I'll say here is that I'm really annoyed at the lack of quality data on this question. And Lindbergh's piece is great. I think that's great data. There's an excellent piece from Baseball Perspectives about a month ago from Rob Maines and somebody I am blanking on. So I apologize that I cannot give credit there, but that's also got excellent data on this sort of like, oh, it's Derek Rhodes, because Derek Rhodes does all the injury stuff at Baseball Perspectives. They do an awesome job of actually tracking this, looking at the days that were lost and the days that hitters lost versus pitchers lost and all of that type of stuff. You should absolutely check all of that out. The people who are not giving us quality data and who are making gathering data harder are the league itself, because Major League Baseball has made so many changes in the last few years that it is almost impossible to untangle what is causing these injuries, right? Is it the sticky stuff enforcement? Is it the pitch clock? Is it making the pitch clock even shorter? Is it taking away mound visits that used to be times where pitchers could rest a little bit? Is it not having good enough recovery practices? Are some clubs getting injured more than others? We don't have access to any of this data. And so we're all kind of like flailing around in the dark trying to figure out which of these things is causing the spike in injuries.
Sarah, is this when I'm allowed? Okay, yes, this is when I can do Q&A. Sarah, hi. I have one question for you. What do you think is the number one correlation between pitchers getting Tommy John surgery or not?
I know the answer to this because I was reading something
earlier
today, and it is the increased velocity, throwing right. just harder and harder and harder. And I think that, you know, I'm going to agree with you on this point because there's a handful of players out and about on the social medias today that you should definitely go check out what they have to say, including Robert Stock, noted guy who throws like 103. Jameson Taillon, dude who has struggled through a bunch of injuries in his life. I think Alex Wood is on the record with this one too. And they're all talking about how they're being like the game is forcing them to throw harder and harder and harder at all points in time, which makes intuitive sense, right? If you can throw 102, your team wants you to throw 102. They don't want you to throw 97 and stay healthier longer. That is a problem. I'm not saying it's not a problem. I'm just saying there are like six other factors that could have caused that dude throwing 102 to blow out his elbow, and we're not entirely sure it's just the 102.
Sure, absolutely. And I'm actually one of the first people to tell you that just by throwing hard does not mean necessarily that you will, because if you have good mechanics, there are people that have not gotten Tommy John to throw incredibly hard. There in baseball history, we've had these pitchers who throw incredibly hard and not had it, and or at least waited 10, 15 years or so into their career before they needed to, right? Nolan Ryan, oh no, at 47, he finally busted his elbow, right? It's Justin Verlander later on as well. Obviously, there are things you can do to be better at it. On the other hand, there is no gate that says you have to have that in order to throw 98, and thus we won't put you in a situation to succeed without it. So until we do have some sort of gate or some sort of way of understanding, hey, look, this is going to be detrimental in such a way that even if you are throwing 98, 99, yeah, you can't do that for a long time. Thus, we're not going to draft you. We're not going to put you through the ringer of this. We have to showcase you could do it somewhere else, which we are not. There's no incentive for teams to do that because, great, I have a guy who throws 99. Oh, no, he's hurt. We go to someone else who throws 98. It's not that big of a deal at the moment. So we are going to see these injuries because they're going to be throwing harder. There are exceptions, but that doesn't mean that we're not going to see it. And I think it was a great point about April and September. Absolutely. Those spikes are larger there. However, this trend of how many UCL injuries or Tommy John surgeries between the majors and minors over the last 20 years is staggering and pretty conclusive. I mean, I don't really know how anyone can look at this chart and think, oh no, this is not a major problem. Maybe that people are more inclined to get it now than they used to. At the same rate, it's just so clear that this is damaging elbows, and we're just increasing velocity, the number one correlation to getting these surgeries.
Nick, I have a question for you because you brought up Justin Verlander, and he had a really interesting interview yesterday that I thought was pretty fascinating and relevant to our conversation here. One of the things that Verlander talked about is that early in his career, there was more of an emphasis of pitching to contact. There was not this emphasis that you have to strike all of the guys out at all times. And he also blamed the leap for this to some extent, because he said with the ball changing, you had this big rash of guys who are hitting these oppo flares that used to be outs to left field. And they're all of a sudden going all the way out of the yard for 2017, 2018, and 2019, which led front offices to change what they were asking pitchers to do to get more strikeout stuff, to get more swing and miss stuff, to get more velocity, instead of pitching to contact a la a Kyle Hendricks type pitcher. Mm-hmm. So I'm just curious, how much blame can we put on the league here for constantly shifting the rules of the literal baseball, the what you can use on the baseball, the how the baseball gets thrown? Because I don't think we're in disagreement that injuries are increasing or that the way pitchers are pitching is part and parcel of that. But I think we are in disagreement as to how much blame MLB deserves here, because I think the league deserves a lot of blame.
So, I mean, that's a very interesting point. I think I personally think that we give too much credit to the front offices of major league ball clubs. And I imagine the ball change wasn't necessarily a, oh no, now we have to change the game. It's more of showcasing a flaw in how analytics was being utilized. If you remove that whole game of, or remove the whole ball influence, you just think about baseball. What is more of a sure out, a strikeout or a ground out? And it's just more analytically sound to ensure a strikeout because there's no chance of that being a hit and negative to my team. So when that happened, it became such a problem that guys needed to go in and say, wait, hold on a second. Maybe that's not a good idea. There is an interesting suggestion that you are presenting here, really, that what if we deaden the ball a ton and make it more inclined to? Well, then I say, you're still going to get strikeouts and then you're just going to get less runs. There's no reason right now for pitchers to not try and get strikeouts because at the end of the day, that is analytically the best outcome. If you say that all contact is bad, then fine. Then, of course, just hit the ball, try to do it, and you lose. You're just trying to get a walk at that point. But we're not going to go so heavily to that realm. And I don't think that we were at that realm beforehand, before the MLB changed the ball to be the bouncy ball. And I understand, too, the grip and losing the grip and all that kind of stuff. It's all weird and crazy. But at the end of the day, there's no denying that to be a better pitcher, it's to throw hard. And if you don't make that an incentive, then maybe we can fix this. But until we fix that, it's going to still be a problem and just get worse and worse.
Yeah. I kind of agree with Nick. Like, I was, you know, having like a discussion with my husband about this because he thought it was like the pitch clock. Like, he was kind of like blaming it on that. I'm like, no, I think it's like so many other factors. And especially, I think it's like velo and spin, right? I think that's a lot of it. And you know, I don't really know how to fix that either, because even if you have, let's just say, half of the pitchers that are in college right now saying, oh, I want to preserve my elbow, I will throw slower, there will be like that other half that's like, I don't care, I want to go make my money. So it's a really, I don't know how you fix this. It's like the cat was let out of the bag, and I don't know how we put the cat back in the bag, which is a really weird thing to say because I don't want to put a cat in a bag at all. but yeah,
put
it's like
I back in the tube.
Exactly. So it's like I don't know how we fix this. I mean, I think that we should try to fix this because it's awful to see people like go under, like having to go over under major surgery and then not play for a year and do all that rehab, and it's just awful. I mean, I just don't know the answer. It's yeah. But I want to kind of take this just one, if you don't mind, just another like put a little fantasy spin on it. Next year, if let's just say the injury rates kind of die down in like 2 weeks and then kind of spike up again, like Sarah was saying, in September. Is it going to change how you draft starting pitching next year?
I mean, y'all are coming over to my side finally. Okay. All right. No more are we going for pitchers early. There are two schools of thought, and I'm actually curious which one you side on, Sarah. This is question two. This is the second debate, because you can think of it this way. Let's say the top 20 pitchers next year, right, are all like, okay, that's the elite class. And we're saying, okay, you should expect that half of them should get hurt. On one side, you're thinking, well, that's a 50% chance that I've wasted an early pick that is way safer getting a hitter. And then I'll figure it out with my other guys. So then I say, cool, I'm just avoiding it. But then you can also say, great, I'm going to hoard it now. Because now the difference between me and the average is so much greater because they don't have any of those elite guys. Maybe I'm going to have to stream strikeouts or something, or punt strikeouts. If I don't have any of those, they're there, right? Where would you side on that, Sarah? And I'll take the other side of it, Sarah. Which would you go for, hoarding them if this is this elite commodity, or then just going, no, I'm out? That's pretty much what Shelby was asking anyway, but it's such a weird idea and I don't know.
Well, I think we've seen what the market does with this, right? The market says that as pitchers get hurt, pitchers get pushed up, right? When you look at what happened with the main event this year, as closers went down, it wasn't like people were like, ah, I'm not going to take a chance on Adbert. He just like his draft price jumped, right? So did Ryan Helsley. So did Andres Munoz. So did Pete Fairbanks. Same thing on the starting pitcher side. You know, Gerrit Cole goes down, and it's like Corbin Burns' ADP goes up. It's just like a cyclical thing that we do, because the incentives are, if there are fewer of them, I need to get my one or my two. The problem is there is risk factored into your one or two. There's player or there's position player risk too, right? Like the Trevor Story injury was terrible. It's not like position players are immune, but there's nowhere near the same rash of injuries with position players that we've seen with pitchers. I think that there's two different things going on here. One might be it actually makes it more likely that I would want to draft two pitchers rather than one early, because then the odds that both of them get hurt is smaller. Although my Tout Wars team started Spencer Strider, and then in like the eighth round, I took Justin Steele, and that's working out fabulously for me right now. That's okay. It is what it is. In that league, there are, you know, you're going to have to change the way you approach pitching. And one of the things that you might want to do is punt the most risky types of pitchers, right? If you want to punt the guys who throw 98, you're probably not going to win your strikeout category. But like, I don't know, Jose Quintana hasn't blown out his elbow, and neither has Martin Perez. I'm not going to defend Kyle Hendricks today, because I do actually think Kyle Hendricks' third time through the order is very, very cooked at this moment in time. But there are a bunch of guys out there who are throwing five or six innings without the flashy strikeout numbers and pretty good ratios, who you can take later and not have to worry about exactly the same risk that, say, a Spencer Strider has.
So here's the thing, is that you're just preaching what I'm all for about, like, hey, you don't need that guy at the top to then win your leagues, because you'd be surprised in 12 teamers how easy it is to find worthy guys each week. I am going to push back a little bit that we can see Shane Bieber right now, who was throwing 82, 83, has to, you know, looks like he's getting Tommy John now too, right? You have Tristan McKenzie also looking like he's cooked. It looks really bad at 90 miles per hour. Something's going on there. It's not always the high velocity one. So if you want to say, like, okay, Joe Ryan is the best of the best now because he throws 93, maybe there's something to that. Maybe there's something to Aaron Nola throwing 91, and that's why he hasn't burned out over 6-7 years. While Zach Wheeler has to constantly get questioned, Zach Gallen is still okay. Even though he threw 240 innings last year, but he's even lower in velocity, but he's still making it work. Like, those aren't the 97, 98, 99. Actually, a really telling thing for me about the whole velocity stuff is Eno Sars put out a tweet about just, I think, the top seven starting pitchers in velocity last year. And it's like just Bobby Miller and Hunter Greener left. And it's like, oh no, this is, oh no, Cole Reagans, please don't take my man from me. Don't do this. I mean, even Tarek Skubal had, like, his fifth inning was way down velocity, right? And there is something to that if we can identify. And I mean, part of my thought process of all of this is, can we make guys throw 93 with amazing attack angles and IVB? Can we do that? Because that works. That's what Joe Ryan does, right? That's okay. We don't need to throw 97 doing this, 98. And we don't need to do that all the time. If we just have a good angle and good break on it, then that is enough. That might be the way that people go. The thing is, you don't have that data when you're in high school or with college, and you won't get the same opportunities because you're not doing it.
I mean,
it's strange.
One name who we are not going to talk about later today, so I'm just going to throw it out right now, who fits exactly what you're talking about entirely, is Shota Imanaga. And Shota Imanaga is throwing 93, but it looks like 98 because he comes at you with that like 5-6 release point, and then the ball's got a little bit of rise on it, and he pairs it with that splitter that is definitely filthy. I got to see it with my own eyes, and I was truly impressed. But the thing I might have been most impressed with Imanaga in the last couple of starts that he had, the last two innings that he threw against the Dodgers, his velo was down, and there were people in the pitcherless Discord who were very concerned that, like, is Shota hurt? I don't think Shota was hurt. I think that it was cold and rainy at Wrigley, and he wanted to get out of those innings fast. He threw, I think, 10 pitches to get out of two innings, just like pitching to contact and the conditions.
Right.
It was utterly brilliant. I've watched the Cubs target those pitch to contact guys for the past few years now with their starters, not with their bullpen, but with their starters. Marcus Stroman, come on down. Jameson Taillon, we've got a spot for you. I was honestly truly concerned that they didn't sign Jordan Montgomery, because I was like, he's your guy. He's right there. He pitched us a contract. Like, what are you doing? Like, that's your guy. So I do think there are teams looking to decrease their injury risk by going all in on exactly the type of guys you're talking about and being kind of out on the big strikeout heavy velo dudes.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think the Cubs were, my take on that before, which I might be rethinking now, was the infield defense is really good for the Cubs. So you want to be leaning into more ground ball focused guys, and you don't want the ball to get up in the air to the whatever the Wrigley wind does on a given day, which is why the Imanaga signing didn't quite fit. However, I mean, I told you back then, Sarah, four for 60 is like the greatest steal. And I could not believe that that happened when it did. And meanwhile, like, Frankie Montes is getting the same thing over 2 years. And I don't get it. It makes no sense. But that's a really interesting point about injuries. Stroman did get hurt as a Cub. Tyone has gotten hurt as a Cub. It hasn't worked out this way, but it might, you know, we're talking about the correlation of everything. Like, generally, it should. So, yeah, look at Justin Steele. Like, sure, that's a hamstring thing, but that's he's that kind of mold, too. That's pretty interesting.
I do think it matters if it's your shoulder or your elbow versus your
100%. Back. Absolutely. Yeah.
We are well over on this.
I know. I told you.
I knew we were not going to be able to hold Nick probably 2 o'clock. But that's okay. Nick's got great things to say. We've got great things to talk about, but we're going to have to talk about them on the flip side of a commercial break, because we need to go to our sponsors really fast. Come back. We've got tons of awesome player debates on the flip side. And we are back. I think that Nick is going to moderate our second debate, yes! Which is going to be about a specific pitcher
right.
We all have questions about.
Whew. Wait, hold on. I have a gavel. Okay. So I have a gavel here. All right. So contestants, we have Sarah Sanchez over here. Of course, Shelley Verstrate over here. And the topic today is Max Fried. Two starts that were just an atrocity, an 18 ERA in two games. Is this man cooked? Shelley, we're going to start with you.
Yeah, it seems really weird to be like the positive person on this podcast, because I don't know. Maybe it's just me being just, I feel like I'm always negative. But anyway, I'm going to be like, if you have Max Fried on your roster, don't freak out. It's totally fine. It's not great, but it's fine. He faced like really two good offenses. He faced Philly in the first time out at Philly, and he didn't even get out of the first inning. That's fine. That's okay. And then he faced Arizona in Atlanta. Still not great. Still got like bashed around, right? But it's going to be fine. Believe in the Braves. Believe in Max Fried. He had injuries last year. He had a forearm injury, and I believe he had a hamstring injury as well. But anyway, he still finished on the mound and he pitched decently. So he's still trying to like work through things. Just believe in the Braves. They don't have anyone else, because Spencer Strider, sadly, is probably going to be gone for the rest of the year. So they're just going to have him out there. They're going to let him pitch. And, you know, the Braves are like one of like the best offenses in the league. So once Fried gets his bearings straight, I still trust him to go like 5-6 innings, get that W for you, and still pick up like a few strikeouts. Yeah. Is the ERA a whip going to be what it was two seasons ago, last season? Probably not. But he's still fine. Like, especially with all of the pitching injuries, you can't drop this guy. You just gotta just ride it. That's all I'm saying. Just ride it. It'll be fine.
All right. Sarah Sanchez, your time starts now.
So I'm pretty concerned about Fried. And to be clear, I didn't draft him anywhere this season. That was mostly me being concerned about injury stuff with the two injuries that he had last season. And I was trying to limit risk with pitchers, which we all saw how well that went. I have two concerns about Fried looking at his data. And I want to echo two things that Shelley said before I get into this data. The first is, you're not dropping him, so you got to ride it out a little bit. And the second is, there's nobody else for you to go get at the moment who can do what he can do, right? So this is not like, I think you should drop Max Fried. It is, I am concerned. I'm concerned because while his fastball velocity is still sitting where it was last season, his secondary velocity is all down a couple of ticks. And his four seam is getting hammered as a result. And I don't know if that's because pitcher or hitters are seeing it better, but hitters are slugging 889 on that four seam right now. Last season, they slugged 409 on that four seam. And that could be small sample size noise, but it looks to me a little bit like hitters are just seeing what Fried is offering better than they used to. And those secondary numbers being down could be one of the reasons for that. The second thing that I'll say here, this is a number I only look at for outliers, right? Like to see, is something crazy going on? Max Fried has already given up a ball that went 114.4 miles per hour this year. He hadn't done that since 2019. So something is going on in terms of the contact he's allowing that is very different than the contact he was allowing in literally thousands of pitches over the last four seasons. And that's why I'm worried about Max Fried.
Well, I'm going to award this to Sarah Sanchez for this debate. However, does not mean I agree with Sarah Sanchez, but this is a debate. And the thing is, Shelley, I think you brought up, you missed the most important point about Max Fried. And by the way, order. Sorry, I needed to do that once and I don't know why it was dead quiet. Max Fried always struggles in April. And actually, if you look back in 2021 and 2022, his first two starts were like a 90 ERA each in both seasons. He does this constantly. And then what did he do? I think in 2021, he had like a 2.4 ERA after. And then he had some injury that was happening in 2022 and came back and had like the same exact thing. It's a constant thing for Fried as a slow starter. I don't really think that I mean, if you look at the first game, he got burned. He threw a 2-2 pitch right down the middle, like what's called a ball. And then everything inning continued and he got pulled after that. And he would have gone out of that. It would have been a great opening day. He was sitting 96 plus. It was up on his fastball. And the recent one against the Diamondbacks is a little more concerning because it is slower. But I think that Max Fried, way too small of a sample. We see this all the time from guys. Max Fried has such a long history of being one of the safest pitchers in baseball when he does pitch for a full season. And I'm seeing nothing at the moment that suggests that he is not going to just recover as he always has. So I'm going to award this to Sarah for the debate, but you're wrong, Sarah.
I think Shelley still gets a rebuttal or some questions if she wants.
Oh, right. I forgot the format. Like, oh, my gosh.
The debate.
No.
Also, I have a lot of questions about why Nick has a gavel, but we...
Don't worry about it. The judge's gavel.
But Shelley, I did want to ask you, given what Nick was just saying about April, I mean, I agree with that, but I actually view that data a little differently. Like, Fried in those Aprils was hurt and like then spent a bunch of time on the IL. So if he hurt, is he one of our pitchers that we're just waiting on the other shoe to drop? I hope not, by the way, because like I really can't, my heart can't take any more pitcher injuries.
Yeah, I mean, that's honestly like if I had to pick if Max Fried was cooked or not, I definitely would have said cooked. But I went with the pro side because I was trying to be positive. I think that there's something going on, like personally, like yes, he does have slow starts, but I do remember I rostered him in, I think in like 2022 or 2023. It's the only time I've ever had Max Fried in redraft or in dynasty. And he had a hamstring injury and, you know, left for like a couple months, but it was fine. Yes. So maybe there is something going on. It just seems, it's just with like everything from like last year, it's very concerning. Everything from what he was dealing with last year and then what seems like every pitcher is dealing with this year. It's just like, yeah, this is not great. But honestly, still hold on to him. You're not going to drop him. You're not going to find anything better on the wire.
Buy low, guys.
Yeah, definitely.
Buy low. Max Fried.
That's a 3-0 for buy low on Max Fried, by the way. Like, we all agree that you're not doing better on the waiver wire. So if you have somebody who will trade Max Fried to you right now, get in on that Max Fried action. We're going to figure out why Nick has a gavel at some point during the show. That's the new mission of the podcast. We're going to move on, though, to our third debate, which I am moderating. And I'm just going to admit, this is a guy I have in a lot of places. He saved me at the end of last season in a couple of leagues. I was very in on the move to San Diego out of Yankee Stadium. And Michael King, y'all, is not looking like the guy that I thought I was getting a steal on in those mid rounds as I was drafting him to be, I don't know, my SP3, SP4-ish type of situation. So we will start with you, Nick. What is going on with Michael King?
Not much, honestly. He's just hanging out. The obviously, you have the Korea start, so you can, or the game, I should say, the relief appearance. It was weird for everybody. We were all collectively throwing that away as analysts, I think, for pitchers. Then you have the first start of the year that was horrendous, right? I mean, that's the thing that got everybody worried. He had 7 walks against the Giants. And he actually had an interview about it later saying that his, when you're a pitcher on the mound, you have a process when something isn't going right, when you're not hitting your spots all of a sudden, what are the, you know, the checkpoints that you hit? And he mentioned that he had one that he just didn't do and just completely forgot about it. And then he fixed it. He had 7 innings of amazing baseball like Michael King. I mean, he went 7 innings in his last game against the Giants. It's 1 walk, 4 hits, 0 runs, 4 Ks. Like, he had 19 combined called strikes on his 4-seamer and sinker, which is exactly what we expect with it. And what do you know? We have the changeup working as it should with 7 whiffs over 20 thrown. I mean, this is Michael King. He's great. He's safe, secure. He had that one blip where he didn't have, I believe it was his, he didn't have his like same cadence with his breath. I got to remember this exactly right. But there was something as simple as that, just like one of the things like, all right, okay, I need to do that and really get there. I was letting everything get ahead of me. It's something along those lines. I don't remember, but he fixed it. And yep, it's Michael King. So everything should be good now. I have no worries whatsoever.
All right, Shelley. Nick has no worries about Michael King. Are you worried about Michael King if you're rostering him anyway?
Yeah, I think I am. I mean, his last outing, you know, against the same team that he walked 7, you know, he walked none. So, I mean, there was a change there. You could definitely see it with the control. But what you also didn't see was like the strikeouts. And I mean, I know Nick cited whiffs. So it may be something different, but the swinging strike rate was only 7%. It was 4.5% in the start, you know, in his first start. I'm not really counting Korea, even though it was absolutely fun to watch. I really don't know. I was encouraged that the Padres let him go 7. I think it was because he was cruising, but I think that there might be some bumps this year because this is his first season transitioning to a starter. So you're going to have those games where, hey, maybe he loses that breath thing and he forgets to before throwing the pitch and he's like wonky again. So I think it might be like a little bit more of a roller coaster ride than many fantasy managers were expecting. I don't really have him anywhere because I didn't really believe really in what he was doing last year. So maybe I'll have egg on my face at the end of the year, but I don't know. It's like, again, like with everyone that we're probably going to talk about today, you're not going to drop him. There's no one there, but I don't really think that he's going to do what he did last year with the Yankees. Yeah, I just didn't see the hype. So yeah.
Do you think, Shelley, that the sweeper for Michael King, which last year was a very successful pitch one, really helped with those punch outs, 16% swing strike rate last year. Do you think that its putter rate, which was slightly above average then, currently has a well below average put away rate. It also has a sub 10% swing strike rate. Do you think that's kind of who he is now? Or do you think that after the small sample he's had this year that he might fix that?
So he has less swing and miss from his sweeper this year than he did last year?
Yeah, it's about half of it so far, of course, in a very small sample of how many thrown.
Yeah, you might not know the answer to this question, but is that over the entire year or is it only when he was starting? Because
great question. I don't have that answer in front of me, but I actually, I believe he had a better strikeout rate as a starter.
As a starter? Okay. Yeah, I mean, that would only be my only rebuttal would be he is transitioning to being a starter this year. So he's still trying to figure things out. And if you can grip it and rip it for like an inning, that's quote unquote easier to do, even though I definitely cannot do that. So, that would probably be my rebuttal to that. It's like, maybe he's still trying to figure out the whole starting thing.
Sure. So to answer your question fully, as a starter, as of August 24th, Michael King had a strikeout rate of 31%.
Okay. Well, good for him. I just don't think that we're going to see that this year. I just think, sure. You know, Nick, you have always said, like, when pitchers get in a groove, they're just in it, and then the season ends, and then you have to get back into that. So it might be a bit, maybe be the second half, and we'll see that 30-odd% strikeout rate. But it might be a little bit, you know, touch and go here before then.
You know, Nick, that question and Shelley's reply about whether it was in relief or starting, I think about that with King a lot. Like, in looking at his pitch mix, for example, it's just kind of all over the place because it's got this very different pitch mix as a reliever, and then it kind of like transitions into his starting, and it's really hard to untangle if you're just looking at a graph. I do wonder, from your perspective, though, how much do you think changing parks and changing circumstances, like the difference in, like, literally just where the walls are and like how the air is in San Diego is different than what you get in Yankee Stadium, how much do you think that impacts a pitcher's ability to find that groove?
Oh man. San Diego helps pitchers a ton in April and May. Darvish has a whole thing about, like, my sinker's never been better than it was in San Diego. Not to mention, I always reference this, you know, talked about how pitchers in Fenway feel claustrophobic. And oh man, I just never really went through that in my head. I'm like, oh, right, duh. It's all on top of you, and the Green Monster's so close, and all of this stuff, right? Everybody, all these horrible Bostonians are yelling at you, but you know I'm right, Sarah. And I know you know I'm right too, Shelley. I'm not just saying that because I'm a New Yorker. It can absolutely influence you. I would say more so than that, though, is the team context and the personnel you're working with. And I very much do believe in San Diego as a whole. Overall, I would say that Michael King going to San Diego is generally a good thing for him. And I have full faith that this sweeper, which has lost some movement, absolutely, it's still gained more of it back in that second start. And also, it has been the moneymaker for him for a while. He still got strikes within everything. It's not like it's just all of a sudden super wild. These are kind of things that change over time. And the fact that he's still getting whiffs on his changeup, which actually was the bigger question I had about Michael King this year, is, like, I know the sinker and the slider are going to be there. Is the changeup going to be as consistent? And to see 7 over 20 whiffs, it's like, oh yeah, okay, cool. I'm going to trust that sweeper is going to get more whiffs in the future. So I'm really excited about Michael King this year. And I was super happy to see him bounce back last time.
Well, I'm glad you're excited about Michael King, because I have a lot of Michael King, and I really need some of my pitchers to both stay healthy and work out. Do either of you feel like you need a rebuttal here? I feel like we have kind of come full all the way around on Michael King.
Yep.
Excellent. Yep. We're going to squeeze in one more debate here before another commercial break, and I am moderating this one as well. You know, last week we were talking about Ronel Blanco, guys who come out of nowhere with a no-hitter. Another guy who came out of nowhere with a no-hitter was Reed Detmers, right before he got sent back to AAA. And the question for this debate is, were we a year or maybe even two early on Reed Detmers? And is he emerging right now? Shelley, you're going to kick us off this time.
Yeah, I think we were. And maybe this is just super, like, FOMO, because I had him everywhere last year in pretty much all of my redraft leagues, and he kind of fell on his face. And yeah, he became kind of like a streamer type, like even sometimes in like 15 team leagues, which was like really disappointing. And I don't have him anywhere. I think that while I don't think that he's going to put up a 1.64 ERA and a 0.82 whip for the entire year, because that would be amazing and he would win the Cy Young. And again, that would be awesome, but he's not going to do that. I do think that there is something there. I think that he's not as bad as he was last year. And I don't think, you know, I think so, maybe like a 3.50 ERA is kind of like what I'm expecting from Reed Detmers. I believe that they have like a new pitching coach in LA. I think I remember reading that Tyler Anderson has pitched really well. Devers has pitched really well. That's probably like the only pitchers in LA that has pitched well. But hey, there was a change, and we're seeing, you know, it pay maybe a little bit of dividends. Maybe it's small sample size. I don't know. But facing Baltimore and Boston, he has pitched pretty well. 12 strikeouts against Boston, 7 strikeouts against Baltimore. I think that this is like, okay. Like, I think that we were probably what we expected from him last year is maybe what he's going to do this year. And maybe it was just like a really good buy low opportunity, you know, on draft day.
All right, Nick, what is your case that we were not early on Reed Devers?
The toughest thing that we do as analysts is to take a very, very small sample and say, okay, this is going to be extrapolated out for a full year, or if it's going to just be one of those days. And I do want to mention, last year, Reed Detmers had a 12 strikeout game. He also had a 10 strikeout game. And what is interesting this year is that it is different. That is, his four-seamer is becoming more of a weapon than it was previously. He's actually gained IVB. He has gained vertical break on this four-seamer that has turned it more believably into an overwhelming pitch than it was last year with the same locations. Actually, I shouldn't say that, because his locations are worse. Reed Detmers is not an incredible command pitcher. He can be good with his four-seamer. He can be good with his slider. And this is what made me enamored for two straight years. I have his bobblehead behind me after his no-hitter. And even that no-hitter, he'll tell you, I was not pitching well, right? That was, it was a case where Reed Detmers had these moments that made me so fawn over him. And more so with the slider down and in to right-handers, with a curveball he can effortlessly throw for strikes. And he even had, in September last year, added a changeup that looked, hey, this could be a good compliment. I want to be really in on Reed Detmers. I so badly do. At the end of the day, we have not seen that slider look like it used to. We saw even in the Baltimore game, when he had 12 strikeouts, a ton of bad misses with that four-seamer. And I do not believe that this curveball is this forever generator of good strikes in the zone. The changeup is still, we don't know yet. The locations of it are terrible. Its mistake rate is through the roof. I think it's like 17%, and an average mistake rate is like 7%. And a defined mistake rate, that's just a pitch in the zone that is double the chance of allowing a hit. You don't want to throw mistakes. So 17% is an atrocity, especially for a changeup. So there are still a lot of flaws for that Detmers has. He has moments and a new thing that could take him forward, but he also isn't showing some of the skills that got us to like him in the first place. So it's an exciting time right now, but we may not actually have the year of Detmers ahead of us.
Yeah, I'm looking at some Detmers data right now, and this is a question for both of you, actually. One of the things that jumps right off the page to me is that he's throwing his four-seam more than he ever has, and he's doing it with pretty solid effect, but he's throwing that pitch more than 50% of the time. If that pitch is not as good as he needs it to be, and he's throwing it more than 50% of the time, that could become a liability real fast, because now you just have to sit fastball and he's throwing it more than half of the time. Shelly, I'm curious for you, what do you see from his four seam in particular? Because you're absolutely right. I'm looking at those strikeout rates from Boston and Baltimore, who are both teams that have hit the ground running this season, and it looks like they were getting fooled, but I wonder how much of that is him just changing his pitch mix.
Yeah, it really could be. It could be that the book is not out right on the quote unquote like new pitch mix that he is throwing. And maybe it, you know, he's facing, you know, Boston this weekend in Fenway, which I struggle to honestly use any pitcher in Fenway. So, I mean, maybe it's going to come to head, but I don't know. I just think that I think that we have seen some interesting changes. So at least there is like some type of change. Yeah, Nick can throw all the IVBs and whatever, but hey, results are results. And that's how you win fantasy leagues right now, is results, not IVB. Sorry.
Skills preach to future success. Not, you don't get points for the past games, Shelly.
Well, that's like if you already had him on your roster, you already have what, two wins?
I'm talking about the future of how to assess what those results are going to be.
You know, just write it until it gets shaky and then use him as a streamer.
There you go. That sounds good.
Yeah.
Well, that's a question for both of you. So it sounds like Shelly is willing to roll with Detmers until he's ready to, until, you know, whenever. I mean, you're already starting it against Boston and Baltimore. Let's roll, right? Nick, you see Detmers as more of a streamer?
Okay. So the debate is over, I assume, because I'm in on Detmers. I just wanted to show that argument. What's really crazy is that Detmers' mistake rate is 0% on his fastball. Zero. I didn't know that until just looking at it again. That's insane. That's crazy. This is a much, much better fastball now. And that's why he's leaning into it more. He has double the swing strike rate, over 20%. The concerns I had are still present. Like that slider, hey, he lost it. I should have mentioned the guy who fixed it was Buddy Carlisle in the minors. They fired him. So I don't know like what supporting cast he has. I know that some of the Angels starters have done better than expected. Some of them haven't. Tyler Anderson has, but he also faced the Rays, who are not a good offense right now. And I would say the Red Sox on the road are not nearly as threatening as well. I know there's a third team that they faced, and I wasn't really that worried about it. It was the Baltimore, as I should say. And yeah, Sandoval did good in the second start, but not the first one against the Orioles. It seems kind of status quo where Detmers went outside of LA and learned how to throw an IVB fastball. That's good. I like him. I have him higher on the list than I expected right now. And I think the changeup can be better, but there really is still this lack of refinement on the entire arsenal that I hope it's not just a cherry bomb. I hope he actually settles into a real approach that can stick.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you kind of just blew my mind with that mistake rate on his four seam, because that four seam is what he has changed and is leaning into this season. It's going to be real interesting to find out if Reed Detmers is the real deal or not. We are going to take one more quick break for our sponsors. But on the flip side, we have a couple more debates. We have our love it or leave it. You will not want to miss any of it. So come right back. All right, we're back. Shelley has our next debate, because I have to be involved in this one.
No, never mind. I'm so sorry. I skipped the questions. I what am I doing? I don't follow the show sheet. What is that?
There's a rundown.
What? No way.
We have rules.
Yeah, but there was like something interesting that I kind of found this morning and I didn't expect to find. I was just kind of like looking at, you know, box scores and stuff. I'm like, oh, Javier Assad kind of did something interesting again. So I get on, you know, Baseball Reference and just kind of like look at him, because I'm like, I've never really been necessarily the biggest fan of his. And I was surprised to find that he has a career 2.96 ERA in the majors. Again, it's only 158 innings pitched over three seasons, right? So it's not necessarily like the biggest sample size, but to be honest, I was not expecting to see a 2.96 ERA from Javier Assad. So is he legit? Like, is he a reliable guy? Sarah, as our resident Cubs fan, I'm going to go to you.
All right. So I'm about to make a case that I know is going to drive Nick crazy. And I apologize in advance, because the thing about Javier Assad and what he is doing is almost entirely grit and guile. It has nothing to do with like location, or he's got this great pitch here. He just goes out and shoves. And I've been kind of mystified by it for every start that I have watched Javier Assad. And when he first came up, I was like, I don't really believe in this. And then watched Javier Assad pitching for Team Mexico. He came in relief in the World Baseball Classic to face an absolute murderer's row of Team USA. And he faced them one time through the order, got 8 of 9 guys out, gave up one single to Mike Trout, and was just nails. And I was like, how is he doing this? I think he's doing it a couple of ways. Javier Assad has a legit starter's mix. So he does have multiple pitches that he can use and command, and he uses them in ways that are not predictable. So he's not like one of these two pitch guys. And he's not like one of these guys who's just like, you know, it's the sinker. Like the sinker is the thing, or, you know, it's the slider. The slider is the thing. he's kind of just an old school crafty pitcher. He's using all the tools at his disposal in order to get guys out. And I think that from some probably advanced game planning help that he is getting, working with an excellent Cubs catcher behind the backstop in Yan Gomes and some really good game planning people in Chicago, they are consistently putting together game plans that allow Javier Assad to exceed expectations. Yesterday, I was watching him against the Padres, and what the Cubs bullpen did to Javier Assad yesterday is criminal, and frankly, I might never get over it. But he pitched 5+ innings, gave up 2 runs. Honestly, those 2 runs were a home run after a walk that should not have been a walk. It was definitely a strikeout. Fernando Tatis struck out prior to being walked in that play. He was this close to like a scoreless strikeout 6, just like absolutely wrecked the Padres, totally shoved. And as far as I can tell, the worst starts or the worst appearances, I shouldn't even say starts, the worst appearances Javier Assad has had are appearances out of the bullpen when he doesn't have that sort of like ability to plan out his course of attack against the entire lineup. He is absolutely a guy who can go 2 times through just about any lineup in baseball. Sometimes he can go 3 times through that lineup. I don't think it's something that you want to like, he's not the net going to win a Cy Young Award. And he's not even like Justin Steele and what Justin Steele does with weak contact, but he absolutely is a guy who can give you 5 or 6 innings. And every now and again, he'll do it with some strikeouts too. And I think it all stems from the fact that he has a lot of pitches and he uses them in ways that are unexpected.
Well, you know, it's not fair. It's not fair, Sarah, to start, you know, in front of Shelley with Soto and Ercillo to suggest that a player has a dog in him. That's just pandering, okay? And you know better than that. Javier Assad is fine. He's fine. He is a crafty southpaw who happens to throw with his right arm. He throws sinkers inside to righties. And he throws cutters away to righties, and he has a pretty blech four-seamer, and his slider is decent to righties down and away. And lefties, he doesn't really know how it's going to work because he throws sinkers that sometimes are front hip, sometimes are down away like Marcus Stroman does best. And the cutter cannot get inside. The four-seamer doesn't really work against it. The slider he doesn't really touch and doesn't do well, and there's nothing else there. So Javier Assad's whole attack is I need to get this on the ground and jam guys, use that Cubs defense, which, hey, I'm a fan of, and I better locate this correctly. Against lefties, it's, oh my gosh, this cutter gets destroyed. Please do not touch my sinker. Let me just get some called strikes on this. That isn't really a recipe for long-term ability, so much so that the Cubs were like, yeah, we don't want you actually to start this year at first. They had other guys, they're like, you know what? Yeah, no, we don't. We don't really want this to happen. Then they said, fine, we're going to keep you stretched out. Same with Smiley, same with Hayden Wesneski. They weren't even comfortable enough to say that Javier Assad was ahead of those guys until later on. Because Javier Assad is fine. He is the buffet that you open up with a tray and you say like, oh, I guess it's just the normal eggs. Fine. And you have it because you need a breakfast at the hotel. Okay? It works. It's sustainable. The Cubs are going to love Javier Assad, but for your fantasy teams, he is 100% a matchup-only streamer that should not be trusted for a long time. Throw in the fact that Javier Assad is so hyper-reliant on command that this is going to go in waves. It did last year when we saw Assad in the rotation, and we saw it when it was in against weak opponents, and then we saw it when it was in against strong opponents. And yeah, it's okay against the weak teams. I would say even the Padres, you know, they are above average. Assad made his way through it, I guess, somehow. I watched a lot of it. He executed some good pitches and made it work. But this is not someone that you go to the waiver wire and pump your fist because you see Javier Assad there. I'm okay in the short term that maybe, hey, Mariners are coming up. You know what? Maybe you'll get those 5 innings. That's great. But I would imagine if things are looking south in any way, Javier Assad is getting pulled out of those games. And you could have even seen him gone sooner yesterday if it wasn't for an 8-0 lead that I think the Cubs held on to, if I remember correctly, Sarah. And I'm so sorry. That is cruel. That is to get back at the pandering you did. I needed to even it out for a second. I'm so sorry. But that does not make Javier Saad worthy.
I don't know if I accept that apology. That was a really painful, a really painful loss yesterday. And Javier Saad definitely deserved better. Although, in honor of one of the dogs that Shelly has there, Orsillo, Shelly, I do have to share with you that like somebody had tweeted out Orsillo's call of the Fernando Tatis go-ahead home run. And I couldn't bring myself to listen to it, even though I love Don Orsillo. As you know, we've talked about this before. And I was just like, as much as I love Don Orsillo, I cannot bring myself to watch this right now. I'm going to bed. And Don Orsillo liked it because he is that guy.
Yes.
He knows. He knows, he understands and appreciates where that was coming from. Back to Javier Saad for 1 second. I don't disagree with what you're saying about who Javier Saad is, Nick. I think it's kind of funny and incredible. And I make jokes all the time about the fact that the Cubs are just cranking out number five starters. They're just cranking out that number five, number six guy. They've got a ton of homegrown guys that are like, hey, we can give you five innings and like strike out two and it's going to be fine. And that actually isn't a terrible thing to have in your farm system, a machine that can crank out some guys who can go at least one time through the order and maybe two if they're having a really good day. The thing I will disagree with you on, as all of these aces go down, as all of the dudes who throw 98 have an elbow issue or a shoulder issue or something else, I think the Javier Assads of the world actually start to look pretty darn good because you know that he's going to throw five innings. You know it's not going to absolutely torch your ratios. And since July 1st last year, admittedly, this includes some relief appearances because I didn't run the exact right filter. So in 89 and two-thirds innings, he's gotten 86 strikeouts. He's walked 30 guys. The ERA is 2.21. The FIP is 3.87. You could do a lot worse on your waiver wire chasing after like an Edward Cabrera than you could do with Javier Saad. And I just think Javier Saad deserves some respect. I think the man should be more than like a number five, number six starter. He's the number four starter for the Chicago Cubs right now because injuries are a thing. And, you know, he's probably going to be like the number six or seven starter on your fantasy teams, people, the way injuries are going this year. So buckle up.
So the question at hand was, is this legit of 158 innings of a 2.96 ERA? And I think we can all agree. Actually, Sarah herself admitted that she does not agree with this because she said five innings and two earned runs, which is a 3.6 ERA. So I think I've won this round. Now, however, gavel here. No, I can do this. There you go. I have a bellhop bell because of course I do. That it bangs with my gavel. Now, I do want to note that he is a streaming option. And it depends on the league that you're in. 15-teamers, as I wave around the gavel, 15-teamers, Assad has more value. I don't think he's going to go full six, which means the win chance does go down for Assad. In 12-teamers, you might be able to get in shortly and out. There are a lot of really interesting options on your 12-team wires right now. I did the fireside chat with Spore this morning, and there were two guys who are at 1% rostered who actually could become major names this week, and that's Bowden Francis going against the Rockies in Toronto, which is, oh, come on, that's Rocky Road. I'd rather have that than Javier Saad against the Mariners. And I also am just so intrigued that Jose Soriano is going against the Tampa Bay Rays in place of Chase Silseth. And he's a guy who threw 100 miles per hour last year. And you're saying, Nick, that's what we're talking about. We don't want the flamethrower stuff. You're not in a best ball league, Sarah. You're in a league that if you get injured in 3 months, who cares? You don't need him. It's just for a week. So Javier Saad to me is just doesn't push the needle enough. And if you are going to go for those streams, you know, don't settle for less. Go and try and get something that actually can do more for your fantasy teams than Javier Saad. And, oh, I mean, he did have seven strikeouts. I applaud him. Thank you. Oh, Javier Saad, I am so proud of you for that. He has a 27% strikeout rate this year. Oh, my gosh. Javier Saad, that's incredible. What was it last year? Let me pull my glasses back. Oh, 20.9%. Okay. Before that, oh, 18%. Okay. Is anything changed? No, nothing. Nothing that's changed.
We're going to disagree on Javier Saad, but I would just like to close this debate by pointing out that we also disagreed on Justin Steele a year ago. And now Nick is drafting Justin Steele.
Hey, he improved. The main thing about Justin Steele that got me excited was understanding that he had more than two pitches, that he actually utilizes them way different. He makes his four seamer act more like a cutter at times and then strains it out at times. He has different versions of the slider, which if I knew, I would have maybe been more believing. So,
damn, Javier Assad has six pitches.
And none of them are elite. That's
true. We agree on that. All right. One more debate to wrap us up before we head to Love It or Leave It. I think Nick is moderating this last debate. Yes!
Oh, my. So here's the thing, y'all. There's this guy on the Rays. His name is Zach Littell. He doesn't like being called little. No, he is large because he has a 0.82 ERA this year with a one whip. He's 11 strikeouts and two walks across 11 innings and two starts. Did the Rays do this again, or is he just a small sample size fluke? Shelly, we are going to start with you.
Yeah, I will start this debate by saying I'm sorry that I spelled Zach Littell's name incorrectly. That is like one of my biggest pet peeves as someone who worked for RotoWire. I have no idea how to spell any of the Zachs. Is it C-H? Is it C-K? Is it C? It irritates me. Anyway, going into Zach Littell with C-K. C-K Littell. I think that the Rays have something here. Again, like it's Toronto, which honestly, as someone who has Vladimir Guerrero Jr. and some other Toronto hitters, they're not hitting really well to start out the season. But, you know, he pitched pretty well. Six innings, six strikeouts, two walks. Then went into Colorado, held his own. Five innings, five strikeouts, no walks. I think that they have something here. Like, is he going to be like an absolute like league winner or anything like that? No, but I think that he is going to be a reliable guy. He pitched pretty well, kind of doing like the mixed kind of starting, relieving last year. I think that the Rays have something here. The Rays, like they, a lot of like their starters got hurt last year. McClanahan and someone else who
Springs and Rasmussen.
Springs,
yeah. Springs, yep. And Rasmussen. I had both.
They all got elbow injuries. Taj Bradley has an injury like during spring, so they're going to rely on him. Like in the minors, like they don't really have like a lot of like that depth that they used to have the last couple years. I think that he's a fine guy. Like, I mean, going back to either Assad or Littell, I think I'd rather roll with Littell than Assad. But I think that they, again, not a league winner, but I think that you could, you know, get some wins here and there, get some strikeouts, and not, you know, blow out the ratios.
All right, Shelly, thank you for that. Pro Littell over here for Shelly. However, Sarah, you are anti-Littell. Do tell.
I don't know that I'm anti-Littell as much as I'm just trying to figure some stuff out about Littell, and I'm very undecided, which is why if I had a choice between Littell and Javier Assad, I'd probably pick up Javier Assad, but I have a well-known bias on the show, which is I lean into what I know. And so if there are guys on the waiver wire who I know more about that I know why they're doing a thing or why they're not doing a thing or what they're capable of doing, I am more likely to pick up the guy I know than the guy that I don't have firsthand experience or knowledge of. And Littell is definitely in the latter camp for me. When I look at Zach Littell on Baseball Savant, and you look at that like pretty little chart that shows how much they throw a pitch, and like you get an idea of like, what does this guy do? Is he like a four-seam slider guy? Is he like in on his changeup? Like, what's going on? I look at Littell and see a Jackson Pollock painting. I'm like, it's just a hot mess. It's like, here's a four-seam. Here's a slider. I'm going to throw the slider more. I got a split finger. I'm just going to like start throwing it. Now I throw it more. Now I throw it less. And I don't understand what that is. I will say, I trust the Rays generally to get the most out of their pitchers. We have had this debate on Fantasy Feud before, but it's worth reminding listeners who might be new to the show or might have forgotten about it. I trust the Rays a lot more with pitchers who they've signed to long-term deals than I trust the Rays with pitchers who are kind of just like, they're riding out the Arbiers. And we just talked about Drew Rasmussen. We just talked about Jeffrey Springs. The number of guys who go through the race system and like start cranking it on a filthy slider, cranking it on a split finger, and then wind up hurt in 5 months is legion. And Littell just screams that to me. He's throwing his slider more than he's throwing anything else right now. He's doing a great job with it. Is this a sustainable thing, or is this a thing that is going to break at some point in time? And so I don't know that I'm anti-Littell as much that I can't tell what I think about him yet. And if I'm sitting at my computer next week doing Fab, and for some reason both him and Javier Assad were available, which, by the way, they're probably not. So, like, don't get your hopes up, people, at least in a 15-teamer or something, that's probably not happening. But if I were, I would probably be more likely to pick up Javier Assad and let someone else take their chances on Zach Littell. I do find the strikeout stuff very intriguing.
All right. So, Sarah and Shelley, what questions do you have for the other?
Sarah, you said that, you know, if you had either or, either Assad or Littell, like on your waiver wire, are you only for these particular pitchers? I'm just curious. Are you looking for long-term? Or are you only looking for streamers? Because that, especially like in 12 teamers that a lot of people do play, that kind of plays into that.
It's a great question. And I really should have made a note about format. I think that my Assad bias here is probably a 15-team bias, not a 12-team bias. In a 12-teamer, I think that you take the chance on the higher upside guy. And I think that Assad is a floor guy. Like, he's not a super high upside play. Like, if he ever strikes out 10-plus batters in a single game, I might fall over and just, like, have a heart attack. Like, it would stun me that much to watch Javier Assad strike out double-digit batters. Littell is the more intriguing arm and the guy who could do more for you. And he's probably a better streamer, like all things being equal, just in terms of who they're pitching against and where they're pitching. And again, this is so new and it's so all over the place that I wonder how much of it is noise and how much of it is real. And this is right in that spot of pitchers where I miss guys sometimes because I'm like, I'm going to let somebody else take that chance. Go over here. My very safe floor. I know you're going to get 6 innings and strike out 5. Welcome to my team, Jordan Wicks.
Shelley, rebuttal.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, I think I would rather take Littell in this. I think that the Rays are pretty good at finding whatever it is that they're looking for, narrowing in on it, and then they're just going with it. You know, Littell was a reliever pretty much throughout his entire career until he came to Tampa, and they wanted him to start. It's like, when I saw that, I'm like, why do they want him to start? It doesn't make any sense. They probably know a whole lot more about Zach Littell than I do. I'm just going to trust the Rays. The Rays figure out things. I will just go with it until it totally blows up in both me and Tampa Bay's face. So I'm not expecting him to do what he's done throughout these two starts, I think that he is fine, right? Especially in this whole injury weird environment, that just take a ride and see what happens.
All right. Thank you, Shelley and Sarah, for this wonderful debate on the topic. And I am going to award this point to Shelley. And the reason for that is because, Sarah Sanchez, how dare you, A, bring up the man Pollock who spells his name wrong with an O, and B, use Baseball Savant over our lovely pitcher lists player pages owned by Pitcher Gifts, Inc. How dare you? No, but actually to the point, Zach Littell is very weird. I'm just so happy that you guys had to talk about him more than I do. He throws high sliders that don't mess up, and it's so strange. No one does this. He's gotten success with it. Four seamers are really bad, but he locates them well. They're upstairs, but they are just really like dead zone, super hittable fastballs. And he does have some splitters. He does have some other things, but it's really just that slider. It's like ride or die with a slider, which I generally don't go for. I call that the Wascari Noah rule, which is you don't go for a guy that has one elite slider and then not much else. However, Littell's breadth of arsenal does suggest that he can supplement that slider day to day. the Rays are the Rays, and Shelley's point about, hey, you just hit out with the Rays is kind of valid. And if you are going between Littell and Assad, I would absolutely be going for Littell instead. Assad's maybe a one-time thing, fine, but Littell could just be solid throughout the year with more strikeouts. So that goes to Shelley.
I will say that this goes a long way to explaining why I'm always behind in strikeouts in my leagues. Like I am perennially like trailing in strikeouts. I'm like, where are the strikeouts? And it's because I don't take chances on guys like that. thank you so much for that, Nick and Shelley. That was a ton of fun in those debates. We're going to close out the show the way we always close out the show, with a little bit of love it or leave it. One thing from baseball this week that you are into or over. Nick, we're going to start with you as our guest.
Well, okay, this isn't fair because this is not a topic of discussion right now in baseball. But the thing is, it should be, because when we actually have the conversations of this, we can't do anything about it. And it's always when it's happening and we always forget it. And it needs to be a constant conversation. What are we doing with the playoffs? Okay, the playoffs should be better than they are. And it drives me up the wall every year. And I don't care how many times I need to say it, how many times people roll their eyes at me when I suggest it, how much they instantly hate it until they realize that it actually solves all of their problems. Every single team that finishes the regular season with a record above 500 should make the playoffs. And all of the problems that we have around major leagues about parity, about teams getting eliminated too soon, about there just not being enough of a focus on the playoffs in October, get solved. Because A, you have more teams that are viable for it. So you have less teams that are trading and making, or actually you have more interesting trades happening where you don't have complete tanking teams all the time. B, you have the most exciting Septembers for every fan base. Everybody can make above 500. That is so absurdly close every year for so many teams. And now this is incredible. Three, you bring back one of the best things that MLB introduced and then removed, which is the one game playoff. It is awesome. It is the coolest game ever. It's a game seven. Who doesn't want that? And no, you say, oh man, they shouldn't be eliminated so easily. Then have a better record, because you don't need, if you're the number one seed, you don't have a one game playoff, right? It is so fun. And everyone admits that the 2020 playoffs were the best playoffs. Sorry, Sarah, again, I know, but it was so fun. It was amazing. Okay. And you had more exciting games. You had more teams involved in it. And it was right there for us to do it. The owners make more money because it's on TV. The players get more attention. They're all in the playoffs. They all want to be there. Fans have more fun things to enjoy. Why is this not happening? And it drives me up the wall.
I don't know why Nick is like just going after me personally, like, you know, knife to the heart. In the show, but
first it was a positive for you, and then I realized it was the opposite. I just had a memory of that time, but then I realized it was the Marlins winning in regularly, and I felt really bad.
Yeah, the Cubs are not great against the Marlins. That's a whole topic for another day. Yeah, I do like this theory, or like what the playoffs could look like. I wonder what it would look like schedule wise if you had like more teams in one league than another team.
Sure.
I think that schedule, go ahead.
You get to the same point, right? You get essentially like a minimum of this or whatever you want. And then let's say you have a minimum of six or something like that. Then you have anything that's 7, 8, 9, 10, whatever. You have actually like 2-3 days that are just only those. And those are one game playoffs. And that's it. And then you just get down to whatever number you want to have a normal playoff schedule. So it would only be like 2-3 days that you really would have to add that, which is absolutely able to be found. So it would totally work. You can make it all different. If it's seven teams, if it's 8, 9, it's just different types of one game playoffs. It's all there. You just got to do it, guys. Just do it. Make me commissioner.
I think we should put Nick in charge of the playoffs. I'd be here for Nick being in charge of the playoffs.
Bring my gavel.
You bring your gavel and your like little bell thing, which I also want to know where the bell thing came from, but that's
literally, I'm not even joking. My dad gave it to me for Christmas because he said I'd figure something out with it.
Well, and you did.
I'm not. I was like, oh, okay.
Here we are.
Here we are.
Shelley, what is your love it or leave it this week?
Yeah, mine's kind of like a leave it because I was watching the Blue Jays home opener yesterday. And they did like this massive renovation, basically like the whole lower bowl of the stadium. They kind of like space out the seats, bigger seating. It's totally different. That's fine. That's great. The biggest issue that I have with it is I'm a humongous fan of the home plate lady behind Blue Jays home plate. Me and my husband, like whenever we tune into Toronto's games, we always see, is she there? Is she behind home plate? What is she wearing? Does she have a nice scarf? Did she bring her friend? Did she bring her husband? You know, who does she bring? Like, it's always like something that we always look for. But they spaced out the seating. And now instead of like right behind the home plate, she's like way off in this corner over here. No. Again, still on screen. But it just looks totally different. I don't like it. I tune into Blue Jays games, not only to watch, you know, Kevin Gausman, you know, strike out like 10 batters, right? But I also look for the home plate lady because I want to be her when I grow up. Like, she goes to like all these games and right behind home plate. And she's just there looking all coif and just, she is amazing. And I want to be her. And now she is off to the side and not in my view. So I'm very upset with the renovations, even though the seats look amazing and look really comfy. But put home plate lady behind home plate, please. Thank you.
Yeah, I think that the Blue Jays have to get on this. Do we email Canada? Like, how do we get the Blue Jays to the home plate lady where she belongs? I should ask Rob Silver. Maybe we'll have Rob Silver on the show and I can ask Rob how we get the Blue Jays to get home plate lady back where she belongs.
Exactly.
My love it or leave it today, and I'm going to be a little bit coy with this one because I have to do a no spoilers version here because Shelley has not seen it yet, and I refuse to ruin this magical moment for Shelley. If you did not watch the preseason ceremony for the Red Sox home opener on Tuesday, you have to. You just have to. I don't care if you're a Yankees fan. I don't care if you're a Red Sox fan. I don't care if you're a person who hates Boston. I don't care if you're a person who gets like your whole raison d'etre is to like cheer against Boston. You should watch this. It was amazing and exceptional. They had all of the 2004 Red Sox there. And it was touching in ways I did not even expect. I am sure I would bet large amounts of money that I do not have that Yankees fans were tearing up over the Red Sox home opener intro today. And it was baseball at its best because this game is not just stats and it's not just pitch types and it's not just rules and regulations or injuries or things. It is the people that we cheer for and that we fall in love with who make these wonderful moments and memories for us in the time that we spend with this beautiful, unbelievable, exceptional game. And if you are in love with this game, even half as much as I am, you will love that opening ceremony. So please watch it.
I feel personally attacked.
You teared up though, right?
Oh, I haven't actually gotten a chance to watch it.
Okay.
Yet,
so we'll touch base after when you watch it. I'm going to have to know because I fundamentally believe that like it was one of those moments for all of baseball. Nick, we are so grateful that you took the time to join us to debate out some starting pitching here in the first week of the season. Thank you so much for joining us. What are you working on and where can people find your work?
Well, first and foremost, it's my absolute pleasure. This is such a cool podcast. I love what you guys are doing. This is great. And thanks for having me. You should, if you're listening right now, go rate and review this episode on iTunes. It does so much. And of course, Shelley and Sarah put in so much work for this show. They actually did have a show sheet that I did actually read. I just scrolled a little too far. Okay. And it's a great show sheet. You should definitely do something that takes 2 seconds to just rate this podcast and leave them a small review. And of course, you can just check out everything at pitcherlist.com. So including this podcast is a lovely part of our pitcherlisted network.
Thank you so much. And we're so grateful for the opportunity. We love hosting the show and we're very grateful that you were able to join us. Shelley, what are you working on this week and where can people find you?
Yeah, I only have this podcast now. So this is what I'm working on this week. But yeah, you could find me on Twitter, ShelleyV_643. I tweet out some things. I hopefully we'll come back to social media at some point during this baseball season, probably because I need to get all the info for all my fantasy leagues. So you'll probably see me tweeting more there. But yeah, just check me out there.
Shelly is a great follow on social media, but I just want to say whether you make it back to social media more often or not is totally up to you. And like, I honestly respect the heck out of you taking a break from social media, because frankly, I think all of us would be better if we walked away from the screen sometime.
Yeah. Yeah.
You can find me at BCB underscore Sarah. You can find my fantasy baseball writing at Baseball HQ, my Cubs writing at bleedcubbyblue.com, my podcasting here, there, and a little bit of everywhere. As Nick said, please rate and review the show. We're still relatively new, and it helps us a ton if you leave us a 5-star review and a rating, share it with your friends. You can follow the podcast at PL Fantasy Feud on the socials. And until next time.